I'm going to call the Finance Committee together. It is 1:34 on Friday, January 25th. Today we have two presentations coming before us, two departments, Department of Environmental Conservations and the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. We'll start with the DEC, and if the commissioner was to come up after running up the stairs to join us. We noticed on TV as we walked in here, you were still down in resources, sir.
Yeah, thank you, Chairman, and you probably saw I kept begging them to let me go.
All right, do you want to introduce your staff? Oh, well, let me, I forgot I better call roll, I guess. Start with. Today we have Representative Munoz, Representative Holmes, Representative Guerra, myself, Representative Osterman, Representative Wilson, Representative Edgman, Representative Thompson, Representative Newman. Representative Guttenberg has been excused for the next week or so, and at this time I'd like to call the alternate up if he wishes to join us, Representative Kawasaki. We've got several people that are in Anchorage today, so I think this is going to be our group that are going to be meeting. So, Commissioner, I'll turn it over to you if you want to introduce your staff and get started on your presentation.
Yes. Thank you, Chairman Osterman. I'm Larry Hartig, the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. On my right is Tom Cherian, and Tom is our Director of Admin Services. I will be walking through an overview of the DEC's budget. And talking a little bit about the department. DEC's mission is to protect human health and the environment. And we do it in a number of ways. But basically what we do is we set standards for air quality, water quality, for waste disposal, cleanup of spills, spill prevention, you know, what you might need on vessels to prevent spills or respond to spills. And all of these things are designed, again, to protect human health and the environment. We take these standards and then we incorporate them into permits and other authorizations that we issue. And then we monitor for compliance, but we also monitor for effectiveness. You know, are we accomplishing our jobs? And then if people having problems meeting our requirements, meeting these requirements in their permits, then generally what we do is we look at compliance assistance. You know, we try to work with the permittees, the people we've authorized, to try to help them come into compliance. And sometimes if there's just there's people that just don't want to comply, they don't think they need to comply, we do have enforcement responsibilities and authorities, and we'd exercise those. But that's kind of what we do. There's other programs that I'll get into, but that's kind of the heart of what we do. When I measure success for the agency, what I look at are those two factors. You know, are the people in Alaska, are they being provided with good clean air, good clean water, healthy, wholesome food? Are we responding quickly and effectively to any spill? Are the number of spills in the state hopefully going down over time? The severity of spills in the state going down over time? Are the standards that we have, are those appropriate? Are they too strict, not strict enough? Does the science lead us to a different number now? So it's a dynamic agency, and it's a science-driven agency, and it's an agency driven by its mission, human health and the environment. So we have five divisions. There's Tom's division, administration, that helps support the other programs and the other divisions. The other four divisions, there's environmental health. That's our largest division, and I'll talk a little bit more in a minute about that one. The second one is air quality. That's somewhat self-explanatory. They set air standards and issue air permits. There's spill prevention and response. We'll talk more about that, but it's pretty self-explanatory too. And there's water. And water has two components to it. There's the permitting program, which is pretty much what I already described, setting standards, putting out permits, doing monitoring enforcement. But there's also what we call the facility side of the water program. And that's our Village Safe Water Municipal Grant Loan Program, and we'll talk more about that in a minute. The Division of Administration, it's probably pretty much the same as you see with the other departments and what you would expect to see, you know, like IT, financial services, budget, HR, those things. But it also includes the Environmental Crimes Unit. We do have penalties that we enforce that can be criminal penalties. We actually have a few people that are authorized to carry guns, though I tell them to be extremely careful. I don't want to read about them in the paper. I'm very touchy on that one. But They do work with law enforcement, other law enforcement agencies, closely with the troopers and the FBI and Department of Justice and our federal counterparts, EPA, Coast Guard. And they work very closely with the AG's office. But they are under the Department of Administration. The reason for that is to be sure it's depoliticized. You know, if we're talking about criminal investigations, to make sure it's independent, driven by, you know, the right authorities. Some of the challenges in the Department of Administration, I'll be talking about some of the challenges and opportunities for each of our divisions. But when I think of the Division of Administration, one of the really good things that I think have happened over the last couple years that I've been an advocate for some time is bringing some of the human resource capacity from the big admin, the Department of Administration, back into the individual departments. And that's because we struggle with recruitment. The public sector, just like the private sector, has an aging workforce. The demographics are against us. I was in our House resource overview meeting the other day, and Larry Dietrich, our director of the Division of Spill Prevention and Response, he pointed it out. He says, you know, he says, the average level of experience of our spill response managers in DEC is 31 years experience in spill response. That's how experienced we are in responding to spills. And I can tell you, even when we have a very dire incident going on in the state, and they happen somewhat regularly in terms of spills, they don't reach the newspaper because things are taken care of. I have great confidence. I see who's on the team, who's responding, and who's in charge, and I go to sleep at night. I don't worry about it. We have that kind of crew out there, and you know, they're recognized around the country as a good group. But it also says something if they have 31 years experience. I always, when we go to these drills and when we go to responses, I always look around and make sure there's a few younger people there too, you know, learning from the rest of the gang. But they're highly specialized jobs we have. We're talking engineers. We talk about even like food inspectors. It sounds like you just go in there and you stick a temperature in the chili and see if it, you know, it's the right temperature. It's more than that. These people go in and they look around and they say, well, what are the conditions for what kind of microorganisms? Would they grow in this kind of food? You know, what measures have been taken to prevent that from happening? How are they tracking this food so if it gets distributed to the public and there's something unhealthy about it, that we can take it back to its source and do something? It's a much more complicated job. And so when we do recruitment, it's not like there's a huge pool of a labor force out there to draw from. So that's the challenge of one of the challenges of Tom and his group. Going into environmental health is somewhat of a grab bag within the agency. It does a number of different things. It oversees drinking water systems in the state. These are the public drinking water systems that we have in all the different communities. They're heavily regulated under federal law. As you can imagine, the quality of the water that you drink, you just assume it's good. If it's not, bad things would happen really quickly. And so we really watch these systems, and what EPA does is it delegates authorities to different states to manage the drinking water program. So there's a lot of federal law that applies here. And the way these federal laws come at us is what they call drinking water rules. And periodically, there's two new ones out right now that have generated two increments we'll get to in our budget for this year in a position, I think, is they'll come out with these new rules, and then all the public drinking water systems in the state, all the way from Anchorage down to the village, have to comply with these rules. It's mandatory. And, of course, there's a carrot and a stick here. The stick is if we don't take primacy of these rules, if DEC doesn't say, okay, EPA, we'll take these rules, and now we'll make them state law, and we'll enforce them around the state, then what EPA does is it withdraws all our primacy for all the different rules, and they would take over the drinking water systems. And the other stick is they take away our carrot, which is funding they give us each year, federal funds for water and sewer systems around the state, for drinking water systems, drinking water systems in the state. I think, Tom, it's about $11
million. That is
correct. Yeah, about $11 million this year. And so although they don't give us money to run the program to implement these new rules, if we don't, they take away our $11 million. So that's the way that works. So that's one thing that they do. Another thing that, and the drinking water rules is a good piece of what we do, and would be a good piece of the increment that we're going to talk about, is we help communities comply with these rules. Usually they're pretty complex, and to figure out how these drinking water systems around the state can be tweaked to meet these new rules, or if they need to be, and how they report. It takes a lot of hand-holding with our department going out and working with these different communities. So that's a large piece of what we do. Another thing that we do is food safety and environmental health. In food safety, the challenge is, in most states, food inspections are done at a county level. In Alaska, it's only the municipality of Anchorage that does their own food inspections. So what it means is the state DEC, our Environmental Health Division, has to take on the whole state. Other states, it would be county government doing that. And so in Alaska, you can imagine, you know, the places we have to travel to inspect public facilities, which would be school cafeterias, it would be prisons, it would be work camps, you know, it would be seafood processing facilities, people that produce food. It's a wide gamut scattered around the state. And so if we're going to hit those, all these different facilities, and hit them regularly as the federal government would like us to do or recommend we would do, we'd be spending a lot of money on travel. We need a lot more people. We've calculated in the past that to meet the federal recommended standards, we would need 31 more people and about $2 million more dollars to do it annually. And it's just not possible. So what we have to look at is other ways of trying to prioritize what are the most high-risk facilities around the state and target our resources to those. And we think we're being successful at that. One of the things we did over the summer is we revised our regulations, and we looked at some of the less risk types of food that were currently being regulated, you know, small things like jams and jellies that people produce and stuff, and said, we don't need to regulate these. And so we got rid of that and give us more resources to put towards the higher risk.
Yeah, Commissioner, in the last few overviews we've had a number of different questions, and it's really compounded the length of the presentation.
Okay, I'll speed up.
So, no, that's not my point. My point is, to the rest of the members around here, if you got a question, note the page, write it down, and then when the commissioner is done with his presentation, we'll go back and take questions.
Thank you, Chairman, and I will try to be more concise, too. One of the things that we're doing in the Environmental Health Division that is new is marine debris. With the Japanese tsunami that took place, a lot of the marine debris that was generated from that that went out into the ocean is now across the Pacific, is hitting already the Alaska shores, and talk a little bit more about that in a minute. So we're on to air quality. This is our smallest division, and some of the things that we're working with, working closely with Representative Wilson, we appreciate her hard work on this, is the Fairbanks air quality. Because of the high fuel prices, we know that they're having to burn wood, use more wood as fuel, and that's causing deterioration in the air quality, and it's a long-term issue and a difficult problem to solve. So that's a big piece of what that department's working on, right, or that division's working on. And a common theme, I'm sure you're hearing this from the other agencies too, so I don't mean to sit here and make a big point of it, and that is declining federal funding. The only thing I'll point out, that we'll have a slide here in a minute, I think it's on page 11, that really illustrates it, is different divisions in our department have different sources of funds, and there's different requirements tied to those sources. And so a drop in federal funds will hit different programs and different divisions differently than others, and some will be able to react better than others to that. And I'll kind of point that out, but it's a common problem, but kind of disparate effects. Going on to spill prevention and response, they have a different financial predicament, and that's the declining prevention account balance. And I think every presentation I've given to the Finance Committee has touched on this, is a large part of our operating funds, and you'll see this again on page 11, a large portion of our operating funds for spill prevention and response comes from a surcharge on crude oil production in the state. There's what they call the 5 cent a barrel tax, and what happens on that is 1 cent will go to covering spill response, maintaining a $50 million fund for oil spill response, and the other 4 cents a barrel goes to the operations of the division. And with that, you can imagine with declining oil production, then that revenue goes down with it. And so we've reached a point now where the current fiscal year will be okay, and we'll get to the slides here in a minute on it. But then, so But if we delay action, you know, we're going to be into the red probably next fiscal year, or at least very close to the edge. And I'll show you those figures in a minute. But that's the biggest challenge there. The other challenge is this increasing natural resource activity. There's more activity in the state. You know, you think of things like shale gas, like up on the North Slope, but also Canada and their tar sands development, coal development in the western United States, all that being shipped to Asia. Those ships go on the Great Circle Route, and they pass right through the Aleutians. And so what happens if a bitumen vessel, you know, runs aground, or one, you know, full of coal? And these ships are big ships, so even if their cargo wasn't toxic in the environment, they're carrying 1 million gallons of fuel. You know, they're big ships with a lot of fuel, so there's other reasons to be concerned. But they're going right through the Aleutians, and there's more of that traffic, and that's a challenge. And now with the opening of the Arctic, we're seeing more traffic actually coming down over across northern north part of northern boundary of Russia and down to the Bering Straits and cutting by the Aleutians too. So that's another challenge. Next, the Division of Water. I already talked about the two big programs in there, the facilities program and the permitting program, and I'll talk about some of those challenges in more detail in just a minute. So now on page 10, this is kind of the big overview of our fiscal year 2014 budget request. The total operating request, all funds, both federal and state, is $85,271,000. About $49 million of that would be state-generated money. The rest would be federal money. Historically, it's been about 40% federal and 60% state are operating funds. That federal portion, though, there's certainly a lot of strings attached to it, what we can do with that money. So we can only use it for particular things. So it isn't like that's fungible, so that if we can take it and move it over somewhere else to cover a drop in general funds. Below that on the capital request, looking on the left side of the slide, $96,905,800. Again, these are all funds, both federal and state. They're the programs that we operate under on the capital side. That would be the Village Safe Water, and that's 75% federal money, 25% state money. That's been declining precipitously, about 60% in the last 8 years. So that's really going to zero, and that's what we use to fund water and sewer projects in rural Alaska. And I'll talk about the growing needs there. But Village Safe Water, the total federal and state's about $51.5 million in the budget this year. The next big piece of our capital request would be the Municipal Grant and Loan Program. That's about $34 million. And below that would be a pilot project for $5 million that I'll talk about in a minute for Village Safe Water. And then there's a small amount in there for Drinking Water Fund and Clean Water Act Fund. What we have under as federal money, but then even though it's under this a revolving loan program, we're allowed and actually required under federal law to basically have loan forgiveness under that program to a certain percent. And so that's why that's in there as a capital request, because it turns from a loan into a grant, and we're required to do that, but that's federal money. On the right side there, you'll see it's a 2.2% growth in our general fund money, but since we're a small department, it doesn't take much to get to 2.2%. That actual amount of increased general fund is a little over $1 million. And if you look at the pie chart just below that on the lower right, it shows you the percent of all the GF spending that DEC is, and that's about 0.96%. That's what our general fund portion of the state general fund pie would be. Going to the next slide, number 11, this just shows the source of our funds, or for our operating funds. On the left, this would be for the whole department. It's about, you can see the big federal receipt, 29%, and you see we get a lot of fees. That's the going kind of clockwise, that's the orange one. That would be cruise ship fees, that would be fees for air permits that we issue for construction permits. The yellow one, that would be more odds and ends things, including, again, some other types of permit fees. And then general fund match and general fund, and then oil spill prevention and response. But if you go across to the right there, these bars for the different divisions, I'll just point out a couple of them just to be for by illustration. You can see air quality, that other piece, that yellow, is a big portion of their budget. because by federal law, the permitting program under the Air Quality Department has to be managed, has to be run by fees that are collected. And that's unusual. It doesn't happen on the water side. There isn't that federal requirement on the water side, but it means that people we permit with air permits, they have a pretty low, heavy load to carry. They have to pay for that program. That's a little bit unusual in the state. If you go over to SPAR, which is to the far right there, next to the end, you can see the biggest portion of their budget, again, is response fund. And so again, different divisions, different sources of money. On the response fund, on slide 12, we kind of skip over that. I already talked about that one. It's the 5 cents a barrel. 1 cent goes to this $50 million fund that's maintained, and that's what we go to if you have to do an emergency response. And then we replenish that fund two ways. One, we go after the responsible party for cost recovery, and if we can't recover that way, then this 1 cent a barrel surcharge goes on until the fund gets back up to $50 million. So it's maintained at least $50 million. The 4 cents, again, that 4 cents a barrel, that's what's used to run SPAR. The next slide, 13, this is a bit historical, and this slide will probably go away next year because the hole can only get so deep, and it doesn't matter because there's no money in that hole. But it shows that with the prevention account balance, that there's a surplus that was generated, I don't know, 20 years ago or more when this fund was created. And as production declined over the years, we didn't go into the red immediately because there was a little bit of surplus to work on for a while there, and a lot of different measures were taken over the time. I won't go into those to try to lengthen the time that that response fund could continue, the account could continue to serve SPAR. But what this slide 13 shows you is we're going into the red here, and we'll go in there in sometime around fiscal year 15. The next slide, 14, this is a little bit busy, but this gives you the actual figures on the account, prevention account, and the projections. Just to run through it quickly, that at the above fiscal year 13, you see $9.6 million. That's what was in the fund at the end of fiscal year 12, and then this is what's been happening in fiscal year 13. With a 4 cent surcharge on the crude oil production, it's generated $7.5 million. Cost recovery that we've gone after responsible parties that had spills is about $976,000. Investment income, this is the projected income on the full balance, including the $50 million that's in the 1 cent barrel response fund, generated about $1.2 million. So the revenue about $9.7 million combined with a carryover. And then below there's the expenses, the 15.45, that's SPAR operating budget. Below that is a one-time, you see, expenditure. This is for response equipment that would be, is we periodically replace that's staged around the state. And then you see the projected total expenses. So we end up still at the end of the year there for the, if you look at just the year, the expenses and the income, there was a negative 6.4. We spent 6.4 million that we took in, but there's still a surplus because of the carry-in, a 3.1 million. But that surplus goes away as you go to the right. And you can see in fiscal year, it gets 15, it gets really close, the 1.4 million surplus. And that may or may not be there because in the assumptions, and you see in this table, it assumes a flat budget. It doesn't include on the expense side any kind of salary increases or expenditures there. It doesn't. It assumes investment income, 1.2 million, which may or may not happen, depending on the markets, and assumes a certain cost recovery that may or may not happen. So these are all variables. And so if you sit there and you're that close to the edge and you have this many variables, it's problematic. So the bottom line is to keep that account, to keep SPAR going, we'd have to look at an increment in 2015 from general fund increment. The next big challenge for the department on page 15 is rural water and sewer. Again, I talked about the declining federal funds. You see that in the bars on the left, the feds being the darker color and the lighter color being the state contribution. And there's two things you can draw from this. One, as you can see, it continues to go down, both the federal and state contribution, and that the state hasn't been making up the decline in the federal contribution. And that's a point I'm sure that rural communities would raise, because in our
municipal grant and loan program, when I started at DEC, that was about $23 million general fund, and now it's around 34, and the budget, governor's proposed budget this year is $34 million last year. So for the larger communities that use the municipal grant and loan program to fund products in their community, that's been going up, rural's been going down, both federal and state. On the state money, though, on the municipal grant and loan program, there is a local match. Local communities do have to match it. Smaller communities, 15%. Large communities like Anchorage, 40%. There is no local match for Village Safe Water. So there's different equities, but that's a situation that I'm sure you all will be trying to address. The other thing that's, as it goes down, decline the funding, the needs don't go away because these systems age, communities grow, there's changes in federal law that require expanding systems, improving systems, and so that gap just gets wider, and that's what you see in the far right. What we're trying to do to help address the challenges in Village Safe Water is in our budget, in our capital budget, you'll see $5 million in there. And is a combination of things that we're targeting there. Two things. One is continuing what we started last year as a pilot program, looking at new technologies and approaches for wastewater and drinking water systems in rural communities. We're not the only state that's dealing with aging infrastructure and not enough money for infrastructure. There's other, even the big cities like New York have the same, that issue. They got aging infrastructure, and how do they find the money to deal with it? So everybody's looking at new approaches and sort of watching other states. Too, it's not just a new technology, but new approaches, decentralized systems, these kind of things. That, so that's part of what we're looking at is pilot programs to test some of these. The other thing that's part of that $5 million is what I call Band-Aid projects. Because what we have in a number of places in the state is we have little things that can happen. It could even, it could be a roof repair where there's elements are getting into a the drinking water plant and causing problems, or it could be a pipe that needs to be replaced or something, that if we could just go in and slap a Band-Aid on it, we could keep that system up and running, keep providing the service, and if the system goes down, we could lose the whole system. It could freeze up, pipes start breaking, it could be a much bigger problem. But we don't have any bucket of money to go after that we can go to like that. So what has been happening is we come back to the legislature, more often the community comes back to the legislature and says, we need this money. Well, they may get the money, but then they have to go buy it. We have to wait for construction season. We need to barge it out there. And, you know, it could be a year or two before the project actually happens. So we have a list of projects, but we don't want, and I know this is a big ask for this group. I appreciate that you like to appropriate money for specific things. But in this instance, what we'd like to have is, we can tell you the kinds of projects that we're looking at for the $2 million, give you examples, but we need a little flexibility there because we need to be able to move that money around a little bit. So if there's an emergency somewhere that's more of an emergency somewhere else, or we find some other money that we can apply there that we can move the money around. So it's to give us a little flexibility combined with the pilot projects, that's the $5 million. So I think that we can get into the ledge finance documents. I know you get more detail on that, or I could just open it for questions. Do you want me to go into the other documents or questions? The 10-year, I'm happy to go through it, the 10-year look back and a little bit on performance.
Yeah, let's go ahead and do those. And then we'll
okay, I'll do those quickly because I know you'll be getting more information on it. On the 10-year look back, what you see on the graph on 17 here is all this information is relevant. So I say don't just look at one piece of it. You got to look at all of it. Because what you're seeing here is that the black line that kind of goes up and down, this is the percent of the pie that DEC is in terms of general fund. So you can see we're actually going down in terms of what we are as a percentage of the pie, even though the dollar amount has gone up. And those are the bars. And although those bars have gone up over 10 years, there's a number of different components in there. There's salary and benefits. There is the Ocean Ranger program that was added by the Citizens Initiative and is paid for by a tax on vessels. We added the APDS program, the drinking water primacy that I talked about, federal rules that we have to take if we're going to maintain primacy and get to $11 million. There was transfer of general funds from DOA to DEC, where lease costs were now being assured by individual departments, you know, versus through DOA. There was some reclassification of a funding source, what was generally classified as other, now going into general funds. And so this isn't all growth of programs. That's my point. You'd have to break this down to see what each of these are. The programs that have grown, again, are the ones that I mentioned, which are the big ones that are explaining these bars, would be the Ocean Ranger program that was the Citizens Initiative. It would be the APDS, the Wastewater Discharge Permitting Primacy Program. And then there's the drinking water primacy that we've been taking over in steps from EPA. And I think that's the highlights on that one. This next one on page 19, this shows projected growth, and this would be general funds only on 19. And you see the history, and then you see the broken lines that give the projection. The green line, which goes up quicker, that assumes a 5.8% growth per year. Looking at the past 10 years, that's what the average annual growth was. And doesn't go into the reasons for growth. It just says everything that caused your general funds to go up, and we kept projecting that out, this is what it would look like. The lower line there, the more flat line, that doesn't include any salary increases. And that's kind of the department projection. And so both of them you need to add and tweak and get more detail to really know where between there is reality. The next line, or the next page, page 20, this is the same type chart, but it's all funds, not just the general funds. Similar explanation on that one. Some of the, on page 21, these are just some of the assumptions that went into the 10-year plan for the department. We assume a gas line start up in 2016 of the permitting effort. We assume that we're going to increase our rate of inspection for food facilities around the state between now and the next 10 years. We assume we're going to get more federal rules, and that's a given. That's not an assumption. We are going to get more federal rules that we're going to have to implement. We're going to assume that we're going to get a number of large mine projects at least proposed in the state. Whether those go or not, you know, that the permitting process will determine that. But we'll have to process those applications. We see some large ones coming, not just Pebble, but Donlin and Chulitna, and there's others. Capital budget, this is an assumption. Again, this is all up to you all, certainly in the body. Is replacing the federal fund decline with Village Safe Water, with general funds for the Village Safe Water program. Now on page 22, this is the start of the performance slides. This shows generally how we're doing on the timeliness of our permits, the one with the blue bars on the left there. And this looks at all our permits across the department. Most of our permits are issued for a five-year term, our air permits, water permits, our approvals on contingency plans for oil storage and transport. These plans, I would not expect this to be 100%. If it was, I'd think something's wrong, because we have periodically, we'll have something come through the door like a pebble. And then the resources that are needed to deal with that from a permitting effort, they ramp up. And so that means some things that aren't as critical, they may move over. For example, a year ago or so, Anchorage critically needed additional power, and Chugach Electric and Power came in and met with me and said, we have to have this plan, and it has to be up and running in a year. What can we do on the air permitting side? And we shifted some resources over, some non-critical areas over to that, so we could get that done in a year, and we did. That plant was on time, all the permitting, nothing held it up, it got done. So if we were at 100%, that means we could absorb everything that came in when it came in. So do we want to do better here? Yeah. Do we want to be 100%? I think that would mean that we're overstaffed. I think we're doing pretty well. We're not getting complaints, let me put it that way, about timeliness on our permits. To make individual complaints, but not as a systemic problem. The one below that, this is compliance with drinking water. We go out and we inspect drinking water systems, and I'm happy to show that that compliance is going up. That means the water you're drinking around the state is safer. So that's positive. It speaks not just to the division or in the department, it speaks to those people running those systems. The next one on page 23, this shows the number of homes in the villages around the state that are getting what we call first-time service, and this would be piped drinking water and wastewater systems or covered hall systems. These are important because this is what you need to really realize the health benefits of these kind of systems. They allow people to have the amount of water they need for sanitation, for drinking and showering and washing clothes and those sort of things, and the convenience that incentivizes the use of that. So what we're seeing is we made good progress over the years, but it's now somewhat flattening out. And the reason you see that here is there's fewer new projects. For the last 2 years or so, there's been a moratorium on new projects. And the reason is, with the decline in federal funds and the state funds with that, if we kept taking on new projects, we never finished projects, because you'd have so many projects coming in the door that you'd have to spread the money thin just to keep all these projects going, and get spread thinner and thinner and thinner as you took new projects on. So we can only take so many projects. We have only so much money at a time to run so many projects. And these are multiple-year projects. It'll be at least 5 years to do all the construction, the engineering, the construction, back and forth and building. And so what we say is there's a moratorium until we get more of these taken care of, get them done so we don't stretch out these projects too long. But we do plan within the next year or two to start taking on new projects. But it's going to be slower. This line's going to just kind of hold where it is. We're going to really fight to maintain it from going down. The one below that, this is another, in my mind, a positive story, is you look at, this shows the number of contaminated sites that we've closed. And you see that these are the bars, the blue bars. You see that keeps climbing up. So we're doing, you see those keep climbing. And then you see the number of new sites, that going down. That's the orange mound there in the middle. Is so much leveling off. That's because we're taking care of a lot of those historical sites and we're on the known open sites. It's leveling off a little bit, and part of that is, again, I talked about the response fund. We used to use response fund to deal with state-owned and state-led contaminated sites, but one of the ways we were able to extend that fund is a few years ago we quit using the fund for state-owned sites, and we started just doing that under capital requests, and so it allows us to use a response fund for general operations rather than specific contaminated sites. We go for general funds now for the state-owned contaminated sites. And you'll see in our budget a $3 million capital request for state-led, state-owned sites for cleanup. I'm done with the presentation.
I'm going to start the questioning out here by going to page 14 again, which we had discussion on the prevention account. And the... your spill response division
recording stopped.
Makes up 18% of your budget. And so when this money runs out, does that mean you're going to reduce the size of your budget and get rid of the division? And what is your plan? When I look at your 10-year plan, it doesn't show.
Yes, Chairman Osterman, that was actually a question that was posed to us in legislative intent language that Senator McGuire put in there, that was head of our subcommittee on the Senate side last year. And the response to that through OMB is that we'll have to look for general fund increments. That's how we are looking at making up that difference. That is projected to be about $5-6 million a year. About $6 million a year, Tom? That's what we'd be talking about.
All right, thank you. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I see a large increase in FY14 for the cost recovery. Why is there such a jump there on that? And also, what statutes cover this prevention account?
Yes, Representative Newman, through the chair. First question is, the answer to that is, in 2006, there were two pipeline spills that BP had, primarily related to corrosion of pipelines on the North Slope. And at that time, there was approximately, if I remember right, $11 million or so taken out of the response fund for the state investigation of the causes behind that. And then the state brought an action against BP related both to the loss revenue because the pipes had, the production had to be partially shut down on the slope for a period of time, and then also the spill itself, the environmental consequences of that, the response to that, and the cost from the response fund, the replenishment of that, that cost recovery I talked about. Those claims went to arbitration, and the arbitrator's award was issued, I believe it was October, November period. State prevailed. We were awarded about $250 million in that. And that replenished the response account. What you see here is the portion that went back to DEC. The rest would have gone into constitutional budget reserve, I believe. And then the other one was statutory authority. That's in Title 46, but I have to get the exact site. But it is statute. It is in statute, that authority, for the response fund. And so if you were going to change that, it would be a statutory change. For instance, a couple years ago, the legislature, it used to be a 3-cent, 2-cent, now it's 4-cent, 1-cent. That was another thing that the legislature did to kind of preserve the response fund and extend it out. And that was several years ago. That was a statutory change.
Mr. Chair, that's kind of what I wanted to look at there. You know, instead of coming out of a fund request like this, it should be dependent upon industries. You know, that's how that account was set up. So I wanted to look and see where we're at on that. Thank you.
Question.
And the mentality for the last few years of those in power has been no new taxes. So we'll see where we go from that. Representative Kawasaki.
I'll pass. Thanks.
Gary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A few questions. Commissioner, I feel like it's Groundhog Day. I mean, we've got problems here that you're talking to us about that you told us about years ago that haven't been addressed, no solutions, no proposals, and you're telling us we're going to have problems. It's like, well, you told us that 2 years ago. So let me go through them. Let's go to page 13, please. I was sitting in a subcommittee a number of years ago. We knew that we were going to start running out of money to pay for spill prevention and response. I believe it was Representative Harris and I had proposed the concept that many people had supported outside of this building, which is not start spending more general fund money, but to add a couple cent charge, like a 2 cent charge to the 5 cent per barrel surcharge, so that we wouldn't face this problem. And today you're telling us you're not going to dare go to industry and ask for 2 cents. You're going to come to the general fund when we've got declining revenue. So why is it that you've chosen, and the administration opposed our bill to fix that problem. So why is it that you're not proposing maybe a 2% per barrel surcharge to help keep this fund afloat instead of coming to the general fund?
Yeah, Representative Guerra, through the chair, certainly all those options were examined, and there's policy calls there that go beyond DEC, you know, in terms of looking at where the revenue should come from. Some of the parts of that discussion, though, to shine some light on it, is the response fund is used to respond, and the 1 cent a barrel, but also the 4 cent a barrel, with all the activities of our spill prevention and response division, they're not all in the crude oil industry. So the crude oil industry are the only ones paying into this fund, but it's used for everybody. And if you look at the where are most of our spills in the state, over about 78% are diesel spills, not crude oil spills. Crude oil spills are about 7%. So people that are causing about 7% of the spills are paying 100% of the response fund and the operation of SPAR. So that's one point. The other thing is that we did do a number of things with the assistance of the legislature to try to fine-tune the fund. Again, we took away the fund being used for state-owned sites. We also, other departments were having some operations funded out of the response fund. Those went away. I could show you history, probably about 10 different steps that have been taken over these years to maintain this fund. And we would have gone into the red a long time before, but for that. But these are policy issues. We also looked at whether the people that are paying into the fund could be expanded, looking at putting a surcharge, for instance, on fuel barges vessels that come by the state. You know, look at things like the Selandang IU, you know, that was very expensive thing for the state. We react to a lot of ships in international traffic going through our waters that we have to, you know, look at protections and response. So it's the crude oil people are paying a large part of it already, but they're causing a very small part of the spills. And so is that equitable? And then the other point is where does the general fund come from? 85-90% from crude oil production. So when we say it comes from general funds, where is it really coming from? So I mean, you're the policymakers, and I don't mean this to sound flippant, but I'm saying we did look at everything that we could do as a department to extend that fund, maintain the fund. We looked at some of the practicalities around and had those discussions. We worked with OMB to try to craft the best response we could to the legislative intent language. All I can do is give you the facts at this point, but I understand that is an option that's out there, and people have looked at it.
Through the chair.
Director.
Still in a couple of years, there's no proposal other than spend more general fund money. So, you know, you mentioned the idea of charging pass-through ships. I don't want to charge anybody who's delivering diesel to Nome, but pass-through ships, you've got the 5 cent per barrel fund. I guess I would just like to see a proposal. This has been a problem for at least 3 years. So the next problem that we've known about for a long time, if you go to page 6. I was on a subcommittee maybe 2-3 years ago, and the testimony from DEC was we do not have the food inspectors to ensure the safety of food for Alaskans. And so members of the subcommittee wrote you a letter and said, do you have a proposal to fix that? And the answer was essentially, no, you guys should come up with a proposal. So here we are. You've just testified you're about 31 people short to ensure food safety. And I guess we have two choices. One is either ensure food safety, or if we're going to have a flat budget, and I understand the argument for why you would want to have a flat budget, well, if that's going to be the answer, then shouldn't we at least issue a notice to Alaskans that you're not really monitoring food safety in an adequate manner? I mean, it's A or B. We either do it or we tell Alaskans we're not going to do it. So do you have a third option, or do you reject both of those options?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, I think that's there's a middle ground there that we're plowing. And like I mentioned earlier, is that we are looking at ways that we can reprioritize things and say, here are the low-risk items that we think we don't need to deal with. And when we did that by regulation and we decided we're not going to regulate certain activities, certain food, we did require notices to the consumer. It says on there, this isn't inspected by DEC. You know, this is homegrown, home-produced. We did it that way. And then that money then freed up, and you'd actually see an increase in the number of food inspections we did. So we're dealing with it incrementally like that. And when we say we need 31 inspectors, that would be in $2 million increment a year. That's if we were going to go all the way to meeting the federal recommendations. There's no legal requirement there. It's a national inspirational goal, if you will. If we were there, I'd feel safer than I do now. I think that I would like to be able to do more inspections. But the reality is we live in Alaska, and we're dealing with an activity that historically has done it, and everywhere else has done it at a local level. If we're going to do it at a state level, then we're just not going to be able to get in all those communities as often as we'd like. So whether we need to issue a warning on that, I don't know. I always worry if we issue warnings and people can overreact too. So we will continue to look at things, and if we see there's a way of need to inform the public, we would certainly look at ways of doing that.
Just finally, Mr. Chair. Again, it's a problem that right now has no proposal. So, you know, maybe your proposal is you don't want state funds to have to cover city inspections, and you want cities to start paying for it like Anchorage does. Maybe your proposal is nothing. But if it's nothing, then I think you have to warn the public. And right now, it seems like nothing. I mean, you're division director a couple of years ago was pretty adamant that we can't ensure the food safety for Alaskans. We just don't have the staff. She didn't mince any words. So.
Yeah, Representative Garrett, the chair, I think what she would have said was that we can assure that we're meeting those recommended federal inspections that are designed to protect the public. And if we wanted to go there, I mean, we certainly could do that with an increment in the positions if that was the priority that we had in this budget. But there's other ways of trying to get there, and that's what we're exploring, but it won't happen overnight. It'll be incremental, and that's kind of what the way I would describe it is we will make incremental progress, and if we get held up, and you know, we do come back with increments. We've had increments. We have come back to this body and got increments for the more high-risk inspections. We did that where we wanted to make sure we were getting into, like, elderly care homes and that sort of thing. We did get increments, and we did get positions previously within recent years of this body.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Representative Munoz Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you. Is there $50 million now in the response account?
Yes, Representative Munoz, through the chair, there is.
There is. Okay. And by 2015, OMB estimates that it will take about $6 million to subsidize the prevention account. Is that correct? I mean, to make it whole or to make it?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, we're talking that the $50 million, that's the 1 cent a barrel, and that's what I call like a revolving fund. Yeah, we spend out of it, and then we replenish it first through cost recovery. And if we can't recoup it through cost recovery because it's a party that didn't have money, then we would the 1 cent a barrel would turn back on. It turns on and off.
Okay.
But that's not at risk. That
right.
$50 million is not at risk. The what we're talking about is the 4 cent a barrel, and before there was in the response account there was a surplus. And that's what OMB is talking about, is the surplus has been gone through once we get into 2015, and in order to be able to maintain SPAR operations at about $15 million a year, which is their current operating budget, that would take a general fund increment because we can no longer draw down that from that portion of the account. It's totally drawn down, but the $50 million would still be there.
Right. Can I continue? So that's estimated at about $6 million. I think I saw
right.
in a minimum.
$6 million a year would be the...
Have you thought about combining those two accounts? So
they're somewhat combined already, excuse me, through the chair, that there's the income that estimated $1.2 million a year, the earned income on the $50 million, that's been historically appropriated by the legislature back into, is it the prevention account? I get my names right here.
Yes.
That's then used for SPAR. Operations.
So, excuse me, is that something that you've looked at combining since there's more sustainability apparently in the response account, long-term sustainability?
If we spent down the response account, the $50 million, then we'd have to have some way of replenishing it, and that would either have to be leaving the 1 cent a barrel on longer, and that equates to about $1.6 million a year, last I looked, but with production going down, that would be going down. But if it's 1 cent a barrel a year, that equates to about, last I looked, about $1.6 million a year. So even that wouldn't be enough to make up the $6 million a year difference.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, I want to say thank you on the air quality issues for helping us in Fairbanks. It's kind of a no-win situation right now until hopefully we get gas sooner than later. But I guess my question just to you is DEC, with the low sulfur fuel having to be put in and the cost it is to the state to have to do that, we know that PM10 has hit some of the villages where, you know, basically the EPA wants us to, you know, put water on roads because we drive on them because there's no way you're going to pave them. And now with the PM2.5, that's a particulate, for those who don't know what they are in the size. EPA continues to change those. They've done now the yearly. They've been talking about doing the 24-hour. And at some point, we could be looking at other municipalities being in trouble. We've been looking at the numbers at Matsu and Anchorage, and they may soon join us, which is not a good thing. And Juneau just barely got out of it and may end back up. When do we finally get to a point to where, if there are no resources like there is in water for federal, do we finally as a state, I mean, maybe it's a policy call more than it is DEC, to where we can't somehow afford, just kind of what we're talking about on food safety, afford to come down to that without other resources.
Yeah, Representative Wilson, through the chair, I wish I could solve that one myself, but the from a DEC perspective, I look at one of our major roles, again, all, again, consistent with our mission of human health and the environment, so I don't ignore that. I don't, that's our mission. But if there's a number of times that you see, and regularly you see, particularly with the current federal administration, that have been passing more rules and more stringent rules and more often than I've seen in any of my 30 years of doing this kind of work. And all states, it's the first time I've seen it, even states with other flavors of administration are all complaining because states just can't keep up with it. Communities can't keep up with it. So nationally, you're seeing a lot of pushback. So I don't know if that'll slow things down or not, but there's that general pushback that I've never seen before. But a big role for DEC, as I see it, is as these new federal rules come in, whether it's drinking water or air, like you say, tightening down standards or in other arenas, our job is to watch those as they may be coming and looking at, would these work in Alaska? Are they really needed in Alaska to protect human health and environment? And to get our comments in, engage communities, engage industry, engage whoever we need to engage, to try to work with EPA to either change the rules or to change the implementation of the rules. And we've been successful at that in a number of areas, but it's a constant challenge. It's a bigger piece of our work, particularly on the air quality side. It's a big piece of their work, but we're dedicated to doing that. I see that when we have limited dollars in this state, I really think the state needs to be able to prioritize what our needs are and not have those set by Washington, D.C., where we're building plants to do something that may be important in New York but not in Quinnahuck. You know, we may have bigger issues in Quinnahuck than road dust to deal with that we should be prioritizing.
Follow-up?
Representative Wilson.
So is the reason, Commissioner, that we have more money in the drinking water systems because, you know, I know you don't want to choose between water and air, and North Pole we have both not so well. But is there a reason why we have more programs in the Safe Village Safe Water because we have more federal funding and we don't have it in the, you know, air quality issues? Is that why? I'm just trying to figure out why we're putting money into the water issues, but it doesn't seem like DEC and their ask has anything in there for the air quality issue.
Yeah, Representative Wilson, the chair. The drinking water program is just larger because every community has to have a drinking water system, and there's just more work there. That's all it is. I wouldn't say one has a priority over other. I could say air, water, food. Those are all essentials.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. One short one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, just going through the statute books here. Under 4608060, it talks about a report. And the commissioner shall make available a report to the legislature not later than the 10th day following convening. Notify the legislature report is available that include the amount of money expended by the department under the years. But it kind of talks about the money that's spent on these. Have we seen that report yet?
Yes, through the chair, that report I believe was delivered yesterday or the day before. I know it's been delivered. And it is every year, and every year we get a good audit, I'll say that.
All right, thank you, Commissioner. Any follow-up questions, you guys? I know the Commissioner is very good at responding to any follow-up questions, so if you have any questions,
sure.
Contact his office. Thanks again.
Thanks very much for your time today.
We'll take a brief at ease while the next set up the next presentation. Start our next presentation by Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. Commissioner, welcome. You introduce yourself and your staff that are here and start your presentation.
Thank you, Chairman Osterman. I was just looking behind me to verify who was present to my right. Well, first of all, for the record, Susan Bell, Commissioner, Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. To my right, symbolically and physically. No. my right hand is Joellen Hanrahan, Admin Services Director. Just walking in the door, Ted Leonard, Executive Director of ADA, Lorene Palmer, Division Director for the Division of Economic Development, Tyson Fick from ASME is with us, the Communication Coordinator, Don Habiger, Division Director of Corporation Business and Professional Licensing. And I was looking to see if Scott Ruby joined us. I believe he, oh, thank you. Scott Ruby, Division of Community and Regional Affairs. And I think that's the division division director staff, and again, Tyson representing ASME.
Yeah, what we normally do, commissioners, we'll let you make your full presentation before we get into questions.
Thank you. Joellen will assist me with the slides. And as we move to the first slide, our organizational chart, I'd like to make a couple of introductory comments. First, starting with our mission, to promote a healthy economy, strong communities, and protect consumers in Alaska. What we're illustrating with this graphic is the six corporate agencies and the six core agencies. The corporate agencies are illustrated by the dotted line because we fully understand and respect the independence of the corporate agencies, as well as the importance of the appointed board members that help direct their activities and functions. Before we move to the next slide, just want to say that we're working across the department and with other agencies in a number of areas that really reflect our mission, but I think reflect the issues of Alaska, and that's reducing the high cost of energy, working to strategically develop infrastructure, including transportation corridors, ports, communication systems, marketing our goods and services, Alaskans' goods and services, including seafood, tourism, forest products, minerals, film, and just generally Alaska as a place to invest and create jobs and live. And then also, again, I think it's important to reinforce the importance of that consumer protection and regulatory function in our department, creating a strong foundation for a strong foundation and an attractive business climate. We work to provide stability, low taxes and fees, and protect consumers and businesses so that people do know that they're getting the goods and services that they believe they're purchasing. Our core services include marketing, I've just touched on that, providing access to capital for business development, and we do that through our Commercial Development Finance Authority, ADA, and through the Division of Economic Development. Reducing the cost of energy through a wide array of programs. I'll touch on those in more detail when we talk about Alaska Energy Authority. Assisting local governments and unincorporated communities through grants, technical assistance, utility and financial management and planning. And then regulating commercial activities in a wide array of areas, including banking, securities, corporation, professional licensing, the alcoholic beverage industry, and public utilities. I'll touch just briefly on the challenges that we face, but before I, as Alaskans, as well as the department, in doing our work and achieving our mission, and some of these have already been reflected in my comments, energy costs, gaps in infrastructure, high cost of goods and services in rural areas, federal environment, the large land ownership in our state, as well as uncertainty sometimes with permitting delays, denials. Again, an ongoing need to continue to educate markets about our services, uncertainty at the federal level as well as internationally. We are facing declining federal funding for some of our programs, and there's an increased complexity when we look at some of the things that we have, banking, we look at the financial services, we look at insurance. There's an increased complexity there, and we need to keep up with that. We continue to balance that by trying to promote our strengths, our resource wealth, our strategic location, our fiscal health, and the kinds of incentives that we offer to businesses and residents. Our priority programs are in four areas, and let me begin by saying that our budget request for FY14 is $201 million. That's a net increase of $7 million, and that's reflected predominantly in three of our corporate agencies, ASME, AEA, and ADA. And so speaking broadly about the four areas before I touch on the activities and accomplishments of the individual divisions, in the area of economic growth, the Division of Economic Development, ADA, and ASME are the agencies. One-third of our budget is allocated to these three divisions. We're requesting a net $4.4 million increase, which is predominantly for ASME to continue marketing our premium brand, our wild seafood, and in particular something that you'll hear more about through this session and have been hearing about, which is navigating the proliferation of eco-labels and sustainability. So it's something that ASME has been very involved in the last few years. Sustainable energy, our priority program, is achieved through Alaska Energy Authority, again, about a third of our budget, a net $3.4 million increase, predominantly for power cost equalization and positions for Susitna-Wautana Hydro Project. Moving to strong communities, which is includes both the Division of Community and Regional Affairs and Serve Alaska, this is about 16% of our budget. We have a net $28,000 decrease, and that includes some declining federal funds for RUBA, the Rural Utility Business Advisory Program. And then the last area, last priority program area, is consumer protection. Again, a number of agencies, including banking and securities, insurance, corporations, business and professional licensing, Regulatory Commission of Alaska, and the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board, roughly 18% of our budget, a net nearly $600,000 decrease, and that includes some one-time items as well as the prescription drug monitoring grant that's expiring. This slide is a visual representation of the four priority program areas that I was just discussing, and again, you see the $201 million proposed FY14 budget. Moving to the economic growth, as I said, I'd like to touch on some of the activities and accomplishments of the respective divisions, beginning with the Division of Economic Development. One area that we're very active in is tourism marketing and tourism development. I want to highlight that we're continuing to work at the recovery of visitor industry volume. Our full year volume is about 1.8 million visitors. In 2012, we had nearly 1.6 million. We are still working back towards the peak visitation that we had in 2007 and 2008, but we are recovering towards that. I also want to highlight something that both our staff and the airport folks, Ted Stevens, Anchorage International Airport, had a collective success with the business community, and that is Iceland Air Service will begin in May between Anchorage and Reykjavik. And that's fresh in my mind because in another week or so, We will begin a concentrated marketing effort working with the travel trade and the media, and we'll have a contingent of division staff and Alaska businesses and visit Anchorage representatives in that market. So exciting news there. Access is always beneficial not only for the visitor industry, but just creating those business strengths. Iceland is an area that we do a lot of co-promotion through ASME as well. In the area of film, in FY12, we had 25 film productions that were approved for a tax credit. We continue to work on our statutory responsibilities of promoting minerals, forest products, the Made in Alaska program, Alaska product preference. And you'll see a theme throughout our comments that we've been really working to work closely with the private sector as well as other state agencies, including those that are not housed in the Department of Commerce, but we share markets, and that includes things like Alaska Grown, the Silver Hand Program, the airports, ferry, watchable wildlife, and others. We work with the Ardor Program. We work with a lot of small businesses, and at the bottom portion of the slide, we have a very robust financing section in the Division of Economic Development. In FY12, we issued 267 loans, a value of over $31 million. We also distributed nearly $5 million in salmon enhancement tax to a half a dozen different aquaculture associations. And we're also well underway implementing a suite of new loan programs that were approved last year, including mariculture, microloan, commercial halibut charter fisheries, CQE entities, community quota entities, and then last year the alternative energy loan program was capitalized. So the division has been quite busy getting these up and running. As I switch, still in economic growth, switch over to ADA, highlight a couple of things here. First, ADA asset value is now over $1.2 billion. We declared a FY14 dividend of nearly $21 million. The ADA's credit rating was upgraded to AA+. And the activity of the organization, we've been working towards getting the SETS program, Sustainable Energy Transmission and Supply, that was created last year by the legislature, up and running. We completed 17 loan participations, a conduit revenue bond for Providence Hospital in Anchorage. We continue work on expansion of the Ketchikan Shipyard, the Skagway Ore Terminal, developed in partnership with the private sector, acquired the Cook Inlet jackup rig, and then J-Bear on Elmendorf. We are constructing a facility that will be leased back to the military to help preserve the Coast Guard presence in Alaska. And you can see the last statistic there really highlights the permanent as well as the construction jobs that have been created through ADA's financing activity in the last decade. So we turn the slide to slide 10, ASME. Want to note that, first of all, a correction in the second bullet, and I apologize for this. The ex-vessel value, it says salmon specifically, it's all species. Ex-vessel value of our seafood was up 29% from 1.7 to 2.2 billion. And then popping up to the first bullet, one of the things that we track is that in the countries where we have ASME programs, that the exports increased by 24% and the value increased by 28%. I really want to highlight the importance of the work that ASME and the seafood industry broadly has been doing on sustainability. We are out in the marketplace very, very vocal talking about sustainability as a part of our constitution. We're committed to it, and our seafood remains wild and delicious. But that it has been an expensive and time-consuming proposition to navigate this market forces. Let me just touch on a couple more things on ASME. Again, this collaboration. I'm sorry that Representative Stoltz isn't here. I definitely want to be, as he serves on the ASME board, want to thank him for his service, as well as a collaboration with Alaska Grown. And then something that both ASME, Alaska Grown, and other entities worked on was a new program this last year, the Nutritious Foods in Schools Grants. So we'll move to the next slide. Switching to energy, sustainable energy. And again, we have a number of programs in the department that relate to energy. ADA is certainly involved. We have loan programs in the Division of Economic Development. But as we focus on this slide on the Alaska Energy Authority, one of the things I want to note is the work that has been sustained with through the AEA staff on the Susitna-Wautana Hydroelectric Project, recognizing that the legislature established a goal of 50% of our electrical generation from renewable resources by 2025. We're currently a little less than 25%, but with completion of Susitna-Wautana would bring us up to that 50% goal. The study plan for FY13 and 14 was filed with FERC by year end, and we had some positive news in the last week where FERC had initially anticipated a delay and now is back on track, allowing us to proceed, presuming legislative funding, allowing us to proceed with a study plan as proposed. Other renewables, last year the legislature reauthorized the Renewable Energy Fund for another decade. In the first five rounds, $202 million were approved. That's for 227 projects. Round six applications have been submitted to the recommendations have been submitted to the legislature. We've dispersed nearly $40 million in PCE grants, and then I won't read all of the metrics, but there is an extensive amount of training, a lot of technical assistance. We also administered through Alaska Energy Authority the Bulk Fuel Revolving Loan Program, which through actions of the legislature last year is now merged with the Bulk Fuel Bridge Loan Program. That was of January 1st, and I think it will make a considerable difference to communities and entities to have a single application process, one location to go, so we appreciate the support, but this reflects FY12 activity. The Energy Audit Program on commercial buildings was up and running. 60 energy audits, a potential $1.1 million in savings were identified, and that's complementary with the Alternative Energy Revolving Loan Program in economic development. And then a new program that both the state and Denali Commission funded is the Emerging Energy Technology Fund. This last year, right around year end, 16 entities received funding from that. Now moving to strong communities, beginning with community and regional affairs, our local government specialists in our RUBA program are integrated in that what we're trying to do is leverage the federal funding that we get for the division and provide a maximum amount of service to local governments and nonprofits. What a big area that we work in is fuel. I mentioned the bridge loan program. Prior to the merger, we had 16 communities with bridge loans, bridge fuel loans. The Fuel Watch Initiative, we also did a supplemental round of calls last spring, but our typical Fuel Watch is in the late summer, fall time, where we're trying to make sure that entities have ordered their fuel. If they haven't, trying to figure out why. Is it financial? Is it a management capacity? And just making sure that we understand where the roadblock is and help communities work through that. Again, RUBA stands for Rural Utility Business Advisory Program. We assisted over 200 communities, provided training to 161 utility managers, and 72 communities met sustainability indicators. Grant administration is certainly an important activity. The DCRA grant staff in FY12 distributed $1.4 billion to nearly 2,000 state and federal grants. In addition to $80 million in community revenue sharing, we also distributed $29 million for PILT, National Forest Receipts, Fisheries Business Tax, and Fisheries Landing Tax. And Local Boundary Commission has been very active. We support the appointed members on the commission, and transactions were conducted in 9 communities. A couple more bullets on the next slide, just again highlighting the wide array of activities that DCRA is engaged in, including mapping, planning, emergency response. We work very closely with DMVA and DEC and the National Flood Insurance Program. So that concludes the things that I wanted to highlight on DCRA. Let me briefly touch on Serve Alaska. Serve Alaska, it's just four employees. We work with, we have about a $3.6 million budget that includes 285,000 hours of volunteer service, over a $6 million value, and we work with many, many nonprofits and communities throughout the state in that program. I need to point out that on this slide, we have included the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. That's part of our consumer protection and regulatory, so we have a mislabel there. So let me just announce the break as we move into a few metrics on Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. First of all, licensees achieved 87% compliance with laws, continuing a steady increase for the third year. The other thing that I think is very important to acknowledge, and it's taken much work from our admin services director and her staff, as well as the ABC board staff, and that is the transition this last year, beginning in FY13, from the Department of Public Safety to the Department of Commerce. There's a foundation for all of the accounting and IT work that needs to be in place for a transition like that, and it was a lot of time was spent. And then also the ABC board, as we were looking to ensure that maximum services are delivered to the public, one of the things that we did was they're relocating to a new location in Anchorage, moving from public safety closer to the port, and that allows them to keep at their rents. They're moving into a state-owned facility. We have a 10-year lease, and we'll keep a very favorable lease rate for them for another decade. So, again, just trying to maximize the funds that they have available for public services. To the next slide, beginning with banking and securities. There's a lot of metrics on the next few slides, and again, I don't want to read them all, but I'll highlight a few of them. But overarching, what you see is a theme where we have very high frequency of contact with the business community and a lot of contact with the public, with our regulatory and consumer protection entities. In banking and securities, we examined 52 institutions. And I think it's one of the things that when we look at state chartered banks, we're looking to see if they're well capitalized, if they're profitable. We issued licenses to premium finance companies, payday lenders, mortgage brokers, money services. Again, I didn't want to read all of the numbers to you, but that frequency, we had nearly 6,000 mutual fund and investment trust filings. A little over 1,200 broker-dealers were registered or renewed, and we collected about $13 million in fees. So again, a lot of contact with the financial community through that division. Moving to the Division of Corporation Business and Professional Licensing, we have over 60,000 professional licensees that are licensed by our programs. We have about 67,000 business licenses that are issued. One of the things that I want to commend both the division and admin services as well is work in the last couple of years to really provide more transparency to the boards, making sure that quarterly financial reports get to the programs. We had, with the legislator support last year, we were correcting some historical practices, such as the fact that the professional licensing programs were paying more than their share of the shared services, and the other aspects of the department or the division, of course, include the corporate licensing and the business licensing. So again, this has been something that Ledge Finance and Ledge Audit have also been engaged in as well, but it's taken a concerted effort. We've streamlined corporate filings, and again, back to my comment about contact with the public, we had nearly 1,400 complaints, and that resulted in opening new cases and licensing actions. So we'll move on to the Division of Insurance. Again, you see this very high volume of contact. We had issued nearly 42,000 insurance licenses, registered 27 purchasing groups, admitted 19 new insurance companies, one surplus line insurer, and two risk retention groups. Again, from a consumer protection aspect, we had nearly 300 consumer complaints. We opened 57 and closed 35 criminal investigations. So some of this results in additional refunds that go to consumers as a result of this activity as well. So as I move to my last few bullets that I'm going to cover before I ask Joellen to take us through some of the visuals in the presentation, I'll close with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. The RCA regulates utility and pipelines in our state, particularly as it relates to rate filings. And I just want to highlight their work to implement electronic filing that reduces costs for businesses and ultimately for consumers, increases the timeliness and the efficiency, and they've been working to resolve consumer complaints in a timely fashion as well.
Good afternoon. I'm Joellen Hanrahan, Director of Admin Services for Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. We just have a few slides on the status of our budget, and this first slide is showing you our budget by funding source to give you a little bit of an idea of how we're funded and how it's compared from year to year. And overall, we're about 46% funded by designated general funds, and those programs would be in banking and ASVE and ABC, where they're actually collecting some fees from agencies. We're 24% undesignated general fund, and those programs primarily would be DCRA, Community Regional Affairs, and Economic Development. And then we also have some other funds, such as ADA, and our Division Insurance collects receipt supported services. So that just is a visual of our the types of funds we have in our department and how we're doing from year to year on that. We were asked to present two slides from our performance framework. And this one is specific to the Alaska Energy Authority. It's from our key indicators. It's talking that from by 2025, 50% of our electricity generation will be from renewable resources. The 11 and 12 are actually at this time, 2011, 2012, are actually estimated percentages on this chart. But the way that this is being achieved is our statewide energy plan is focusing on locally available resources, our renewable energy projects. We also have some projects that we have private capital in conjunction with the renewable energy projects. And then there has been some federal funding also on renewable energy projects. The second area that we chose to present was related to our communities that are non-compliant with management sustainability indicators and looking for the change in that each year. And what this refers to is that we, our Division of Community and Regional Affairs, spends a lot of time out in the communities to make sure that they can really maintain their operations. They look to see whether they the entity has workers' compensation insurance, whether the required elections are being held and certified, and are the state and federal audits being completed and filed, or do we have any liens or judgments against these entities? The next slide, this was prepared by Legislative Finance, and I guess you've probably all have seen many of these already. And this slide is speaking to all funds for our department and what type of changes are going on in there. And this slide, I would note that you would see on FY14, you could see there's a larger yellow piece there, and the yellow is the designated general fund, and that increase is due mainly to the ASME increased funds and PCE. You'll also note that the blue is, which is the general, I think that's a pure unrestricted general fund, is quite a bit less this year, and part of that is related to the fact that the slide was adjusted to take revenue sharing out. It was a one-time item, and Ledge Finance took it out of 14. And also, the other thing would be that the PCE funding is switching from unrestricted general fund to more of endowment funding. The next slide is showing the general funds only for our department. In our department, what you'll notice is there's peaks, and these peaks are pretty consistent. Consistently, in 09, you'll see a peak where it's up at 40% on the bar. That was when the state decided to invest heavily in the PCE endowment fund. In FY13, you'll also see that the bar is quite high. That's related to revenue sharing. Again, for our department, those peaks are kind of dependent on where the budget funds are available for the big ticket items of PCE and revenue sharing. The next slide was also prepared by Legislative Finance, and this is looking at the general fund only compared to the 10-year plan. The black dotted line is the department's 10-year plan. The green dotted line is Ledge Finance's extrapolation of a 9.8% annual growth over time. Again, it is a little difficult in this department to be comparative because you do get those spike years with the revenue sharing, the PCE, or we brought in a $16 million program into the department a couple years ago. So, and our department is planning conservatively, given the state of the finances on where we're going. The next slide is all funds. It basically shows the same visual as the general funds from both the department's perspective and the Legislative Finance perspective. Commissioner, the final comments?
I think just in closing, in a very similar manner to my opening, I think that we're working to help make sure that we take care of our inherent strengths and that we address the issues that are facing Alaska, particularly in the areas of energy, infrastructure, and helping businesses thrive.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'll start off with a comment and a little bit of comment and then a couple questions as well. And as won't be a surprise to you that my interest is economic development. And I've been looking at following it for the last 5 years on what's been going on with your department. So let's start at page 5, and so I can understand a little bit more about your priority programs. And you've got economic growth, which is my interest, and $66.4 million, 33% of your budget, but including economic development, ADA, and ASME all tied together. So if you separate out economic development portion from ADA and ASME, what kind of proportional percentage are we talking about of the $66 million? It's not...
Chairman Osterman, the Division of Economic Development is about $28 million of the funding there. ADA's nearly $16 million, $15.7 million, and ASME is nearly a little over $29
million. Okay. And you talk about a net $4.4 million increase, and you associated that to ASME. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And your net increase in what?
Chairman Osterman, with each of these, there's some increments and decrements, and sometimes it's a little bit of an increase for salaries, decrements if there's some grants. But predominantly, that 4.4 is related to a change in how the legislative authorization in general fund compared to the program receipts from ASME and the taxes. And Joellen, I'm not sure if you want to augment.
I thought that's what it was. All right, I want to. Drop back to page 3 for a second, and your core services, nowhere on that page does it talk about economic development for a core service for commerce and economic development.
And Representative Osterman, I may not have highlighted it specifically, but I believe two of our strongest programs, when we think about economic development and the tactics that we do, our marketing services, I think, are key in economic development. Our financing programs are essential in terms of our economic development activities, as well as that coordination with the business community and the technical assistance that we provide on incentives, as well as just how to navigate the regulatory environment in our state. But I think our biggest areas of activity are in marketing and finance.
Okay, but it doesn't reflect that. And that concerns me a little bit of why it doesn't reflect in that in your core services. On page 8, you talk about your business development. You provide 400 small businesses with technical assistance. And I'm wondering what that technical assistance, does it generate the increase, the Alaska tax base? And same thing with the regional economic planning for orders. How many plans were implemented that increased the economic tax base of the state?
I think it would be good to follow up, but I do know, you know, some of that technical assistance help includes our contact on things like the Made in Alaska program, helping businesses understand not only the value but the process on Alaska product preferences, as well as our assistance to miners and finance entities through our development specialists in forest minerals and other things. So again, we've been trying to work in this area to quantify the kind of engagement that we have, because I think it isn't as tangible as being able to account for our marketing programs or the number of loans that we do.
My big concern, obviously, is the fact that 90% of our income is on non-renewable resources, and I don't see in this presentation the growth of economic base across the state. Questions? Representative Guerra? Edgman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, just to follow up on Representative Osterman's questions, I would have been interested to see the number of businesses and employees we've added in terms of new businesses, new employees in the sort of non-renewable sector that the department has engendered, and I don't see anything like that. And so as we're trying to evaluate, are we getting a bang for the buck from the department, it would be interesting to know how many new businesses we've generated over the last couple of years, how many employees. The renewable sector, though, there are incentives in those areas, complex statutes, but I'm curious about the non-renewable sector that we'd like to expand as well. So I don't know if you can get us that information, but without it almost suggests to me that it's... Oh, I don't know. Tell me what you know.
Representative Guerra, through the chair, I'd be happy as I work with our division staff to see what data we have or how we can begin to track more of a linkage between our development activities and business activity.
Thank you. And then through the chair. And it's not just the new businesses, because some new business could come up just on their own. I'd like to know what kind of link there is between the work the department is doing and bringing those businesses up. And I know some of that work happens. I've spoken to people at the department. I just don't know whether we're getting a bang for the buck or whether things have to be changed. So if you could provide an analysis like that, that would be wonderful.
We do our best.
And then just lastly, Mr. Chair, very quickly. You had your, on page 13, you mentioned CERB Alaska. That is one area where, oddly enough, there's a federal statute. We added one staff member a few years ago, but that entitled us to like something like $1 million of extra federal funding for AmeriCorps and CERB Alaska programs that work across the state. And I'm happy you're still running it, but I guess that's more of a Les Guerra Bill Stoltz comment, that it's got spinoff money. So, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Representative Edgeman.
Not a Bill Stoltz, Representative Guerra comment, but the other way. I guess my first comment would be that this department, and I've said this many times over, and at least for this year, kind of reminds me of my new legislative district. It just got a little bit of everything. And a lot of everything at the same time. The first comment would be to commend the department and certainly Ada as well for all the good work you've been doing on economic development. I think you know, in terms of what we've done here in the legislature, passing major legislation to allow Ada to have business relationships with private sector companies, new market tax credits, certainly some capital appropriations along the way, really hopefully will set the stage for more than just Jacob Briggs and Cook Inlet, but hopefully a lot of good business opportunities. I think we've added energy in your portfolio now. We did that a couple years ago. But really expand the reach, the economic development arm of the agency beyond, you know, it's not saying that the promotions and the marketing is bad. It's good. It makes a big difference. But being able to infuse major capital budget, you know, opportunities or create along the state, I think will be the big tail of the tape. Slide 18, just as well. Let me. We'll go to slide 18. I'm going to back up. I didn't get to my question. My question was, though, that said, you know, on the energy side, we could talk a lot about what's happening in the energy, and I think there's a lot of good things. But given what I just said about ADA and economic development, is there a point down the road where we need to, because both economic development and energy arguably are some of the more important core services that you provide along with all everything else you do, but is there a point down the road that we need to take that one board, ADA and AEA, and separate it into two boards so they can properly lend their efforts to, you know, two of the bigger challenges public service-wise in the state going forward?
Through the chair, Representative Edgeman, first let me thank you for your compliments on behalf of ADA and all of the department staff. And second of all, I appreciate your insightful comment because ADA and AEA, as you noted, are served by one board, and both agencies have really grown with the support of the legislature and the governor in terms of tools that you mentioned through ADA, and then the many programs that we have AEA do. I think that as you have an opportunity to, if you interact with the private sector representatives on the board, I think that it would be valuable, and I'd be happy to include the follow-up to this committee, their names and locations, because they really are doing, I think they're going above and beyond compared to other board service that people might do when they're in a voluntary position to guide an organization. So I acknowledge what you're saying about the work growing. I think we need to watch that, and I think we really need to appreciate the private sector members that are serving, because there was another action that was taken not too long ago where we changed the composition of the board. And so rather than having two or three commissioners and two private sector members, that was changed to two commissioners, revenue and myself, and five. So again, I think it's worth watching, and also worth watching the activity of those respective agencies.
Representative Holmes.
Well, can I have a follow-up to my...
Well, if you want one.
I just wanted to make the point that this this is a good graph, but it does bear a little bit more examination in the sense that, you know, there was another slide that talked about $202 million in renewable energy grant. We put major money into hydro projects over this period of years in the transmission lines and so on and so forth. But, you know, when you still look at the amount of energy statewide that's produced by hydrocarbons, it's well in the 90 percentile. I think, you know, natural gas, like 57% or something like that for all the space heating, and then you add diesel and it's 94-95%. And this graph almost would lead you to indicate that we've made major progress in these years, when in fact, when you put it in its proper context, we've made a slight incremental progress. And that's not to say anything bad. I mean, you know, I would return back to, you know, commending the department, because I think you've done a really good job with AEA and everything you've done here, but this is a slight uptick in the scheme of things, and I don't need to ask my neighbors from Fairbanks about that, but this is just a slight increase statewide in an area where our challenge is still very much largely in front of us, you know, getting to the point of having affordable and stable energy across the state.
Are you done?
I'm done. My next speech is
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We seem to be doing more talking at this point, and I promise there is going to be a question at the end of my comments. First off, I just wanted to underscore what was said by Representative Edgman and the co-chair, that obviously you've got a lot on your plate, but there's a real interest around this table and in this building working with you on the economic development piece. We've got, you know, 90%+ of our state economy coming out of one thing, and how do we do more value added? How do we continue working? ASME's been doing great work on that, and there's a lot of opportunity, but I think you're sensing a theme around this table that we really want to work with you on the economic development stuff and help make everyone successful. While I'm on it, and one more thing before I get to my question, I want to give you and Don kudos over the last few years for all the work you've done on the streamlining of the business licensing and the professional licensing. I think it's making it faster and easier and cheaper for businesses across the state. And so I know there's still more work to do, but I want to give you guys a pat on the back for taking that so seriously. And now I actually do have a question. Over the last couple of years, we've given you guys a couple of new things on your desk, one of them being the ABC board, the other being the tourism marketing. Of course, tourism is one of our top three revenue generators here in the state, and lots of businesses and lots of jobs. So I was wondering if you could just delve in a little more, give us a little more insight on how it's going, having those two under your tent.
Through the chair, Representative Holmes. First, I'll talk about the tourism, because we have had the development specialists in the Division of Economic Development for a number of years, and we've had now with FY12 and FY13 responsibility for the implementation of the tourism marketing program. I first think it's going very well, and part of what we've done is try to make sure that we continue having the industry engagement while we're directing the programs, and we clearly understand the legislative intent. Throughout all of our programs, whether it's formalized, such as the ASME board members and committees, or more informal, our engagement with the business community is really important to how we do business, and we have continued input through the Alaska Travel Industry Association Marketing Committee, making sure that we're ground-truthing what we're doing in our planning process, and that we're making sure that businesses have an opportunity and communities have an opportunity to leverage the state's investment in the program. So I can go into much more detail, but that's, you know, in a short answer, I think it's going well because of the philosophy that we continued with the implementation of the program. With turning briefly to the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board, one thing that we knew from the public comments as well as the directive from the governor verbally and in writing is that it was very important that the public safety aspect not be compromised. And again, the example that I used of the lease and preserving, you know, what is a little bit below market rate, and making sure that we're, you know, they're not vulnerable on that front. We're trying to make sure that their resources go to continuity of the public protection services that they provide. A change like that, as I appreciated both the division staff and admin services does take a lot of work in that transition, the front end work. But I think that we take, you know, we take our responsibilities seriously, and we try to jump into them to succeed. So thanks for asking.
Representative Newman, you had a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, just I notice we've got my good friend Mr. Leonard in the audience here, and one of the things that we didn't cover is some of the investments that are done by ADA, and one that's kind of been on the forefront of a lot of Alaskans' minds, I think, is what's going on with the jackup rig in Cook Inlet and the investments in there, and what are we seeing on that?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, first, you know, just on ADA overall, the you know, our programs, we have the loan participations with the banks. We do have the ability to own or partially own projects, and then we have some of the new programs that were mentioned by me and Representative Edgman, the SETs, the new market tax credits. The jackup rig is one of the projects where using the new powers to partially own an asset, ADA leveraged we were able to get 4-to-1 leverage of private funding for that. So that's one. Two, we were in, when we think over the last couple of years, the urgency of developing gas in the Cook Inlet area and serving South Central and Alaska broadly, we certainly feel like the decisions we made along the way were prudent as a board and staff. But we, I have to say, as vice chair of ADA, I've been disappointed that we haven't been able to. You know, we're not drilling yet. We communicate regularly through our executive director with the operating entity. It was also in the news probably 3-4 weeks ago. It was around Christmas time about a change in the management and making sure that the that the bills and the employees were paid. So there's been, you know, as we've gotten to where we are at this point, we feel like the investment is still sound. We protected the ADA's assets through the way we structured the debt and the protections to the state. But ultimately, it's not doing yet. It's not drilling, and that's what we wanted. And we're optimistic about where we head in the next year.
I think the base question is, when's that going to happen?
Representative Boston, or Representative Newman, through the chair, in our follow-up, I'll work with Ted to see how specific we can be at this stage.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I've got one question, and Commissioner, when you first came on board as Commissioner, you and I had a conversation about prior things that went on in your department, such as a letter from Boeing looking to maybe expand their businesses into Alaska. And that letter kind of floated around Commerce for a number of weeks before anybody even paid attention to it, and it never got, there was never any action out of it. Last year, one of the CDQ groups from Western Alaska made some inquiries around the state and asked about whether there was the ability of moving $68 million worth of business out of Seattle to Alaska. We responded a little bit as legislators and gave Seward a few planning dollars to try to look at their dock, and nothing's happened as far as I know. Have you had communications with that CDQ group, or have you got a team that goes out and goes after that type of business when it shows up?
Thank you, Chairman Osterman. First, on your example, I know as I came to state service about 3 years ago, and then as commissioner about 2.5 years ago, I know I shared a lot of your concerns about not being responsive enough, not being proactive, not being coordinated across divisions or departments, and in some instances having kind of a narrow focus. And I think that the themes that you hear in my comments and in the respective directors about the collaboration and the coordination and a very, you know, excitement about being our work and being proactive, it's, you know, some of that I absolutely agreed with some of the comments and criticisms that you had, and I think we've, you know, breathed a new life into some of our activities. Specifically on the CDQ group moving, the desire to move some of their fleet, We stay in regular communication, me as commissioner, as well as Ada. And I know a portion of the fleet, not everything is moving, but a portion of the fleet is now able to be housed in Alaskan waters over the winter rather than Seattle. Part of what needs to be done as we get to that, realize that full vision, is not only the dock face, the waterfront infrastructure has to be upgraded, but there's business opportunities. It's not just docking. There's a lot of other work and opportunity that the fleet has a lot of overhauls in the engines and other things, refrigeration. So it's an opportunity that we're sort of biting off one step at a time, but we certainly have a lot of engagement with them.
Can we get a copy of your plan on how you can handle that and who's handling it, please? Representative Munoz, do you have a question?
Thank you. Thank you. My question is a follow-up to Representative Edgman. I'm curious, with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, to what extent, if any, they consider state energy policy in reviewing applications.
Representative Munoz, through the chair, I'd have to follow up specifically with RC on that, and we will.
And also want to say thank you for your service. I think we're very fortunate to have you in the commissioner's seat because of your extensive business background. I think you're very good. Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, there was a considerable discussion going on with tourism and marketing funding. I see in your, you have a request for about $16 million for that and some other funds. I know that there was a look at former Representative Thomas, at a 50-50 match or something like that. I can't remember the details and all that, but where are we at on that?
Representative Newman, through the chair, the funding in the governor's request is $16 million, as it is in FY13. We do leverage that with some funds from communities and businesses that participate in the state's program. You're correct in recalling that there is actually still in statute language that if the state contracts with a qualified trade organization, there's language there that's specific about the match. And it was just a couple of years ago where some language had sunsetted, bringing it back to that 50-50. So at this point, the governor's been committed, as we are as a department, to having a robust marketing program and really working to restore those jobs that were lost in Alaska when our visitation dropped, both on the cruise and non-cruise side. We had a couple of we lost in the neighborhood of 265,000 visitors, an estimated 5,000 jobs over a couple-year period, and we're still coming back out of that hole. So we've been committed to a robust marketing program to address that.
Quick follow-up then. So are we following the letter of the laws as per statute then? I know that at the end of the year last year, we ended up putting in $16 million on that. That's what I was trying to get at.
Through the chair, Representative Newman, if the program, if we were entering into a contract with a qualified trade organization, we would have to comply with the statutes. At this time, we're implementing the program through the department in a similar manner that we did when there was a division of tourism. So,
is that a yes or a no?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious on that very issue. Marketing plans and money spent by the Anchorage Tourism or Fairbanks Tourism, is that money considered as part of a match, or is that not considered part of a match? I mean, if they're marketing and traveling to Japan to encourage winter flights to see the Northern Lights, does their marketing plan count as a percentage of a match at all?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, only when they're directly engaged with the state program, if they're buying an ad in the vacation planner, if they're participating in a trade mission and we're allowing for business partners and communities, are we capturing that match? I know that other destinations and previous legislation that had been considered looked at a more expansive definition of the match, and that may be something the legislature would like to discuss. But right now we have the receipt authority to collect funds for things like I described. it's more of a direct element in the program.
That looks like it. Thank you very much, Commissioner. Appreciate it. Our next meeting will be 1:30. The finance meeting will be 1:30 on Monday. We have Department of Revenue and Department of Transportation that will be bringing their overviews before us. And anything else to be brought for the committee?
Monday morning.
No, Monday afternoon, 1:30.
Subcommittee?
I don't know what the subcommittee is doing.
Today?
No, Monday.
Monday morning, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Double check it. Yes.
All right, with that, we are adjourned.